The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.
Welcome back, everyone, to Vox Markets Live. My name is Paul Hill. I'm delighted again to be able to speak to accomplished UK small and mid-cap fund manager Judith McKenzie of Downing. So, big new year. Welcome, Judith.
Oh, hi, Paul. It's a good start, isn't it? Interesting start, if nothing else.
What a crazy 10 days. I mean, we've had basically the kidnapping of a Venezuelan prime minister. We've also had the Iran protest. And then over the weekend, you wouldn't believe it, the Trump decides he demands sovereignty over Ukraine. And to get that, he slaps or threatens to slap tariffs on the UK and Europe, all NATO allies. So I've never seen anything like it in my 58 years of living on this earth. But putting all that together, what's your sort of like your thoughts on sort of equities over the next 12 months, if you could have any sort of level of certainty?
Well, I don't know if there's certainty, but I suppose what is certain is that the companies that we're investing in are good growing businesses that we're not having to overpay for. And if you think about it, where else do you go in the world at the moment? You know, Japan's got colossal debts, France is a kind of a slow burn fiscal crisis, and Britain, okay, is not the best growth and it's got a kind of high tax funk, but it is actually probably one of the better places to be investing. We're already seeing, actually, I think the numbers were in November, weren't we, from the Investment Association, that there's actually been inflows into the UK market. So I'm trying to ignore the background noise that changes every single day and just keep focusing on the core companies that we've got in the portfolio. And actually, although we thought last year was probably economically quite a challenging year and we had quite a lot thrown at us with the budgets in the end, then, you know, we're still driving 7% type returns. And if you look at our performance over the longer term, which is in the AIM market, so it's not even the mid-cap market, but over the AIM market over the last 13 years, we're up nearly, 188%. So you can drive, and I'm saying that not just to crow about it, but also because it shows that you can drive returns even in quite volatile markets. And if you're a stock picker, as you are, Paul, then you can really find some unloved little gems that can drive double-digit type returns over the longer term. So, yep, messy background noise, but generally pretty happy with where we are with the portfolio and the outlook for the next 12 months or so. And we will get lower interest rates at some point, and that drives equity valuations as well, ultimately. So,
Yeah, no, I'm totally with you. I mean, that's fabulous alpha generation over that sort of 13 years or 15 years when you mentioned. I mean, absolutely terrific. But what seems to have sort of like stopped the AIM market and a lot of sort of like really good companies on their valuation, on their multiples, is that constant outflow of from active fund managers. And I know I spoke to Harwood yet last week, and he said that the Norwegian Wealth Fund had just stripped out a big mandate from UK active fund managers. So given we haven't got many passive index trackers, particularly in the small mid-cap sector, then it's just like, you know, persistent outflows. But there is a huge valuation disconnect because of it in terms of value, intrinsic value, that is, an actual price. When do you think that will be catalyzed? Because we've been waiting a long time for it. It should just be a matter of time.
You know, it feels like Groundhog Day, because I'm pretty sure this time last year we were having a chat and I was telling you about the catalyst that I thought were going to happen over the course of 2025. And I'm going to sound like a bit of a broken record, but it's the same catalyst that really are still in play. And I think, if nothing else, they start to get a bit closer. I mean, some of those catalysts are the same things we talked about, and that is that UK pension funds are looking to invest in UK equities. And it's not just UK equities, it's very much that kind of AIM small cap area. It can't happen soon enough. As Christopher Mills said last week, having that investor go out the market at the tail end of the year was really painful. And that's why you saw quite a lot of disconnect between some share prices. Companies like Cohort were down 30-odd%, a little bit on defence sector. But, you know, just because actually there was money coming out of the market and putting some really strange trades through. So I believe, I'm not certain, but I believe that most of that is washed through. So it won't take much, I'm saying it again, it won't take much in terms of capital coming into the market to actually get things moving again. And today, I think it was the stock exchange opened up this morning on the basis of some of the reforms that been worked on for quite a long time, actually. But a lot of those are to do with giving retail investors better access to IPOs and markets, etc. So, you know, it's a bit of a slow burn, but when it happens, you know, you'll be sitting there thinking, hold on, I missed it, because when the markets turn and capital does come back into the market, which is really what we need, then it happens pretty quickly. So, you know, you're better to be invested. And I don't think, you know, being invested in this market is not a damaging thing. And we're going to talk about some of these companies. They're great companies that, you know, have been around for tens of years and are value compounders and double-digit earnings growth. So if you can pick, be a stock picker, I think you can do it okay out of this market. But yeah, I can't time the market, I'm afraid.
Yeah, well, I'm hopeful as well. I must admit, all my portfolio is in small and mid caps. But one sort of trigger which does seem to be happening as a constant theme is M&A. And let's go. We've got Vicky. Yeah. She's asking about one of your stocks, One Spatial, that got a bid. I don't think they've actually got an agreed sort of formal document yet. It basically is Geospatial sort of software and services across the UK, like for telcos and companies like that. It got a trade by indicating a 73 pence per share. She's asking, what's the sort of likelihood of this going ahead? Because the shares are currently trading at 67.
Likelihood of it going ahead? I mean, it's been recommended by the board. They had to make an announcement because it was a bit of a leak. So I'm not... touching wood when I'm saying this. I think it's the right thing, sadly, for One Spatial. So just to remind you, it's geospatial data management, but very much operating in local authorities and also in the US. So they have got a little bit of software called One Streetworks, which basically does streetwork planning. And US being quite a big market for them. And just with the fiscal shutdown in the US at the tail end of last year, that just led to delays in contracts and just procurement decisions, very quite challenging for them, and that weighed on profits through last year. And really the shares were quite volatile, as we can see there, as just these sales cycles lengthened. So a really nice application, good business, probably better, I suspect, in a larger entity. So I would like to think that this deal would go through. It's the right thing for shareholders, it's the right thing for the business. And as I say, it's recommended by the board. So
it doesn't seem to be massive
or something.
Yeah, the only thing, it doesn't seem to be massively rich. And I know most of the takeovers haven't been, as we know from things like Equals, it was sort of like taken off. And it seems as though quite a few management teams have been battered by the small cap market and actually see a better light in private ownership, which means that, you know, if it's a sensible bid like this, not a top dollar bid, but a sensible bid, the management team are quite happy to sort of become private companies because they just get so battered by the markets and shareholders.
Yeah, yes is the answer. But, you know, if you're on the public markets, you've got to ride with it, was my view. And, you know, I don't like to see a management team being a bit weak when it comes to M&A and just looking for the easy way out, because private equity doesn't tend to be the easy way out, does it? You know, you always find management teams much preferring to be on market than being trussed up like turkeys by private equity. So, you know, here you've got a 57% premium, I think it was, or thereabouts.
Yeah, that's right. 57%
premium. So it's all right. It's okay. It did happen at a time that you'd maybe argue that it's not exactly peak earnings because they've had a tough 2025. So ideally, you'd have liked to see them trade through the sales cycle challenges that they've had and just get a little bit more traction with One Streetworks, both in the UK and US, because I think one of their more recent contracts was with the power networks in the UK, and that's really only just started. So ideally, you'd have liked to see that kind of roll out and get the earnings benefit and then get 57% premium to the enhanced earnings. But I've got sympathy with the board here. So I'm sad to see it go, but I understand why it's happened. Yeah. And yeah, what we don't want, though, is too many things in our portfolio taken out over the next. You get instant gratification with a 50% or a 60% uplift, yeah. but actually we'd quite like to hold our portfolio for the long term.
Yeah. Well, we've got another $64 million question. We've got Alex, he's asking about Traxys, which is an expert in all software and hardware. Bit of a darling about 3 or 4 years ago as the whole digitization of the UK rail network, and it was expanding abroad. Unfortunately, had a sort of like got hit by delays in the CP7 rail situation, and also with the formation of the Great British Railways. Orders have sort of moved to the right. They've still got a big chunky cash pile. I cannot believe they're trading, and they've got a big cash pile. They're trading 11 times PE, and if I get it right, 0.7 of sales for high quality. What's your view on this one? Because if you get a 57% premium on this one, I don't think you're going to be smiling. But anyway, what overall, what's the sort of prospects?
Yeah, I mean, you've highlighted some of the challenges there. CP7, which is basically the buying cycle for the rail networks, I think at the moment the new rail body doesn't have a chair or a chief exec. So, you know, to try and get any certainty on what's happening within UK rail spending is almost impossible. The good thing here is that management have been pretty prudent and made sure that anything that's related to the CP7 CapEx spending has been taken out of forecast. So you're not having to pay for speculation around when CP7 might actually land. What do I like about it? I love the exposure that it's got. It's very difficult to get transport rail infrastructure exposure in UK small cap. Being slightly cynical though, so I was looking at this one the other day, we're just doing a bit of a portfolio review, and the earnings aren't exactly stellar over the last sort of 5-10 years, well, 5-8 years I think it is. Earnings haven't gone backwards, but they've not exactly been, having the growth attributes that, and you're right, it used to have quite a premium rating. It used to be on about 18 to 20 times. And now, sub 12 times. What I'm looking for here is a bit of stability in the US. I don't think that US acquisition was great, and I think they're working hard to really get value out of it. So I think that, and that they're selling into, so that's condition monitoring equipment and rail yard software that they're selling into the large networks in the US. So these are big contracts when they happen. It just takes a bit of time to roll through. So there's that aspect of the state. So really just getting those operations a little bit more efficient. And then in the UK, you've got digital pay-as-you-go that is now being rolled out. I think it's rolled out in Leeds. It's rolled out in the Central Belt in Scotland. And there are trials in, I think, North East Midlands as well. So these tend to be 9-month pilots. So we can see what can potentially be some very lucrative contracts, very good margins, 70-odd% type margins. But these are pilots that are still in trial. So you're then also looking for some kind of certainty around CP7. So any of these things happening will lead to more of a growth dynamic. And I'm happy enough to hold it in the meantime. A new chief exec that's gone in there probably about 6 months ago, David Frost, and he comes from a private equity background. So I don't think there'll be kind of root and branch reform within the business or restructuring, but I think there'll probably be better efficiencies as the core functions are knitted together. So I'd hopefully see some benefit and margin coming through this year as well. And you can look at on an earnings basis, but we'll also look at it on a some of the parts basis. So they've now got quite good ARR, annual recurring revenues on the rail technology side. I think sales there would be about 25 million or so. So you would value that, 4 or 5 times multiple. Mm. So you could get an EV there of 100 million or so. They've got a data traffic and events business, and the events business is pretty much as it says. So they're doing traffic management for the likes of Glastonbury or other big events throughout the year. That's quite a high turnover business, but quite low margin and also quite lumpy. So we've always talked about that business probably being worth maybe, 15 to 20. And then you've got net cash of about 26, 25, 26 at the moment. So, you know, that drives a value close to, on that sum of the parts, close to about £5.86 a share.
Yep.
I know, to where you are sitting today. So, you know, nearly double. So you're definitely getting an upside for either sum of the parts or on a re-rating on an earnings basis. And I think there are enough catalysts there. But it, you know, could be a little bit dull in the meantime. I don't want them to go out and acquire anything just as they get their ship in order. And I think, you know, with that cash in the balance sheet, there could even be a special divvy sitting there or a continuation of the buyback. So, yeah, maybe not immediately exciting, but great sector exposure and you're not having to overpay for it at the moment.
Yeah, that traffic management and events business, I mean, it sounds like they should sell it. And I know they've got some good camera technology and some good sort of revenues, but if it's just as a more of a lumpy contract and it's lower margin, sell that and then you'll get a higher rating on the rest. So, yeah, if David's got his private equity hat on, I'm sure he's getting his teeth stuck into that sum of the parts. Yeah, it's good. Brilliant. Okay, let's move to another sort of hot, well, basically this is almost like a pure software. We've got Dave, he's asking about Eagle Eye, which is basically the UK's number one, in fact, almost the world's almost number one software supplier for promotional sort of like applications that go into big supermarkets. It's going through a bit of, it lost a big contract in the US, but now the momentum seems to have turned. It's just inked four consecutive deals, the last ones being with, I think it was Wakefern last week. How do you see this one? The shares have been up and down, actually.
Yeah, I like this one. I think... I'm going to put my neck in the line here. I think this is probably one of my favourite opportunities for this year, 2026. You're right, I had a bit of a reset during the last year, and that's meant that earnings taken a little bit of a step back on the loss of that large contract. However, we've had, I think, three or four announcements come through on big wins in retail, as you say, in the US. And that's really what I was looking for. So that seeing that momentum come through is quite encouraging. And what I really like about this business, when they had that bit of a reset blip or profit warning, I'm going to call it that, it was, then they were very quick to make the business more efficient. So the professional services side of the business had been a bit of a drug. And that can be nice because they'll be putting folk out into sites and getting paid a kind of hourly rate on professional services. But ultimately, that ends up bringing margins down because this, in effect, it is a software business. So you should be getting really nice EBITDA margins, you know, in the 20s into the margin did suffer a little bit. Because of the dependency on that professional services. But what they've been doing over the course of the last 12 months is really taking that reliance on professional services away, and a lot more efficiency in the business, and also making it so they're not having to put so much support in. And that's meant that they've maintained their margins, even though revenues come off this year. So I think margins are 24% at the moment, and they're aiming to get to 30%. But the prize here is a large OEM deal that they struck about 18 months ago. And it's never really been talked about. It was the worst kept secret. But it is SAP, the big systems integrator. And SAP probably has about 20-odd% of that that payments market. So when you go to the till EPOS systems, etc. So loyalty now gets tied into the point of sale and is highly integrated, whether it be on mobile apps and loyalty or right the way through to online. So that's why SAP was keen to refresh its own offering in the loyalty space. So they signed up Eagle Eye about 12 to 18 months ago. They launched it. They were testing, then it launched in November. And you go onto the SAP website, then you'll see that their big conference in November, the worldwide conference, it was all about, not Eagle Eye, but their branded side of the payments loyalty solutions. And I'm trying to sort of drill into the SAP numbers a little bit, it's quite difficult to try and extrapolate how much revenue they actually get in from payments and loyalty. But I would estimate that it's probably about 40 million a year. I'm not saying that's going to drop down immediately into Eagle Eye next year. But even if they get a fraction of that, then that really underpins earnings for the next couple of years. And given it's launched, given the marketing spend that SAP are putting behind it, I'm rather obsessive about just looking at SAP's website on a regular basis just to see that they are getting the marketing support. So we'll begin to see that coming through this year. It's not, these numbers are not dependent on SAP landing, but it's going to be the icing on the cake. So, and I think on a valuation perspective, consensus is around about 625. Other businesses in the space paid on 3 to 7 times sales, or EV EBITDAs of about 18 to 25 times. And here, I think we're on about 2.4 times, dropping to under 2 times sales on next year's earnings that don't have anything crazy about SAP coming through. So I don't want this to get taken out, but if it was getting taken out, you could see that it's easily north of 600p. So I'm happy with it.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. I mean, I think forecast sales, it's 1.8 times forecast sales I've got. Yeah. And I think a big catalyst, as soon as they ink that and announce the first deal with SAP, investors will think, right, okay, they are really pushing this. That's the last sort of like straw to drop to basically to give investors confidence. And then you're right. I think Tim Mason, the CEO, he's on a mission to double the revenue, isn't he, to about 100 million.
Yeah. So.
He's like an exocet. He's absolutely totally clued up.
Yeah, and you've got Teddy Leahy as well. He's chair. So and Tim himself was ex-Tesco, of course. So, you know, they know all about retail. They know they know about loyalty because they were the ones that integrated Dunnhumby at the time into Tesco. And that was really the first, if you remember, going back about 8-10 years ago, that was the first kind of loyalty card you ever had. So, yeah, they know how to do it. And I really respected the way they reacted to that loss of contract. You know, they immediately looked at how they could make the business more efficient and maintain that margin despite the turnover coming off quite significantly. So, yeah, good management team, really solid.
Yeah, no, I'm with you. Okay, good. We've got Ricky's asking about Gaming Realms, which is basically a software provider for gambling or slot machines. It's got Slingo, which is a combination of bingo and slots machines. Sells to a number. It doesn't actually have its own website, as in like selling it to consumers, but he sells them to things like MGM and Flutter and all the other sort of like, you know, gambling other websites and around the world in the UK. I guess the sort of the question is with... We've had so much change in the UK in terms of betting levels, I think, last April. And now we've got the online gambling tax increasing from 21% to 40% from the 1st of April. How do you see this one going forward? So I think, but reading between the lines, 25 to 30% of revenues come through from the UK.
Yeah. Headwinds, I think, as opposed to any tailwinds for this one. I think, you know, the key catalyst for the next 12 months is further operator integrations in North America and Europe and some new content cadence as well coming through. But I don't like regulatory change and regulatory headwinds. It really means the US has to work exceptionally hard to make those numbers. So I think the shares were off about 10-11% just impacted by that November budget and the gaming taxes levied. You know, the business is growing quickly in non-UK markets, but it really needs to be exceptional growth to offset that decline in the 20-30% that comes from the UK. So it's one that we've got under review at the moment, if I'm being honest.
Yeah, no, it makes sense. Okay, good. We've got Drew. He's asking about Ramsden's, which you've talked about a lot, actually. It's sort of like thought as a pawnbroker, but actually it's got four legs, and pawnbroking is the fourth largest. The biggest is selling gold or buying gold. The next is jewellery, and then the third is financial services. So it's actually a bit of a sort of diversified retailer. Anyway, what's your sort of view on this one? The shares have done it excellently for you.
Yeah, look, you know, the gold price, all-time highs, let's not, and, you know, a good part of the business, and results were out last week, so we've got some quite recent views on that one. Obviously, we saw the real benefit of being able to buy and recycle gold into their stores, but also then get the benefit of the gold price if they're sending it off to smelt. So you're getting some exceptional earnings coming through in the back of the gold price. But I would argue, and actually on the day of the results came out last Tuesday, I think, the share price did nothing. These were absolutely exceptional results. And you know, to see the share price doing nothing, I can kind of understand, given it was up about 83% through the course of last year, with people already sort of extrapolating what the gold price might do for gold buying. But I don't. This is not a one-trick pony, as you say. This is not all about gold buying. It's not all about pledge book. It's now, when you look at what they managed to achieve on the jewellery side, it's quite amazing for a little business based in Middlesbrough. You know, they're now one of the top five retailers of secondhand jewellery in the UK, and that's both online and in store. So they've definitely managed to get that or capture that dynamic quite nicely. And it's interesting to see, this is not, again, all about the gold price. So they've managed to get their in-store sales, their ticket item has gone up quite substantially. And actually, the watches that they're selling now have an average ticket price of over £4,000, which, when you think about some of the demographics of the stores that or the areas that they're in, is no mean feat. So watches are doing well for them, but they've also been really good at just selling some of the gold that's coming in through the gold buying, refurbing it. They've now spent a bit of capital on the refurb site in Middlesbrough. So really good at just turning things around or bits of jewellery around and getting them back in store. And the online model's working well as well. And, you know, the pledge books, again, the average ticket size there has gone up. And it's not just all about the loan to value. They're not having to over loan on the pledge book. It's still around about that 60%, 56% level on what they're getting through pledge. So I really like this business. I think it's very solidly run. They're now launching their store rollout program again. They're planning to open 8 to 12 new stores and to pay back between 2 to 3 years on the stores. So, and some much faster than that. So we're very happy with it. It's done exceptionally well for us. It's up 84%, as I say, over the last 12 months. So you can't help but smile when you say that.
Yeah, well, H&T, one of its competitors in pawnbroking, was taken out last year. So it's not insurmountable that somebody else has a look at it. just for its gold positions, I think.
Well, yeah, exactly. You know, and I do get why maybe shareholders are taking a pause for breath here, because it's on about 10 times, I think, thereabouts.
Yes, that's right.
And that's roughly the level that H&T got taken out at. Right. But I would argue, just going back to your first point there, you know, this is not just a pawnbroker. This is not just financial services. You've got four different arms here that are all actually capable. I've got to scale now where they're capable of driving earnings growth. Yeah. All are contributing. FX has been a little bit off. I think it was down 3%, but more than mitigated by the other divisions.
Yeah. Good. Okay, we've got Charlie's asking about Synetics, the surveillance and CCTV company. What's your sort of your latest views on this one?
Slightly frustrated. So they changed broker, and just at the time when their previous year had some quite exceptional earnings, a £12 million contract that had landed and washed through the course of last year. So really, really helped earnings. The problem and the reason I'm frustrated with it at the moment is that they don't have earnings in the market. And they don't have earnings in the market after we know that they had an exceptional year last year and a contract that had helped earnings. Now, they've had some good contract wins in the period, and but it's very difficult to actually understand what that does to earnings. So we've been left in a bit of a hiatus, and that's why the share price has come off quite as much as it has. I think it's a bit of an own goal, to be honest. You know, they could have handled the market expectations way better. If you're leaving a broker, you've got to understand that it's most likely that they're going to withdraw their forecasts. And if you're joining a new broker, my goodness, just make sure they get a number in the market. So a bit frustrating. I think it's a really nice business. highly operationally geared, and they're going into new verticals now. So they're now in renewables, as well as surveillance for oil and gas networks, and also the casino market has always been part of their kind of core earnings. But yeah, slightly frustrated that, you know, leaving us without market forecasts is not the best. Yeah.
And so that was without forecast. That was solely because they were switching brokers. Because, as you rightly say, it's an own goal. I mean, I don't know the company in great detail, but I would interpret that they don't know what they've got so much level of uncertainty because they've had some exceptional projects last year and implementations last year that they can't actually put a firm number out there. So is it just solely because they're switching brokers? Is it?
Yeah, well, look, companies switch brokers every 5 minutes. This is not a new thing to be talking about. But in fairness, if I'm being sympathetic, Amanda Larner, great chief exec, she's been at the helm now probably for about 18 months, 2 years, maybe a bit longer than that. And there is a bit of a reset in the business, a bit like Eagle Eye to a certain extent. Mm. There had been it probably been more of a kind of box item sale, and to get the real nirvana here, you want recurring revenues. You want more of a software sale to get the margin. So they're making a little bit of investment this year, and Amanda's been very, very clear as to why they need to do that. And it does move the business to the next scale. So it's not just the same old verticals that they're going down. I think actually you could double the size of the business over the next 5 years if they get this kind of restructure and refocus correct. So I don't mind them taking a pause for breath, making that investment into the core business, get more of a ARR type model and SaaS revenue. But it's just been done rather clumsily. So it's not that I don't think that they don't have enough of a pipeline or visibility. It's more really to do with that reset when it comes to really looking at the shape of the business for the next 5 years or so. But yeah, it would be nice to not have that hiatus without numbers in the market.
Yeah, I mean, people who don't, you know, are looking to buy shares, if they can't see any forecast of a company, you're right. Yeah. I'll go somewhere else where they've got more certainty. Just take it as a negative, don't you? Anyway, okay, good. That's excellent insight. Okay, let's move to one you've talked about a lot in the past, Cohort, the defense specialist, does products and services into electronic warfare, counter surveillance, and all this sort of stuff. It's done brilliantly, obviously. Had a bit of got sold off, as you said. What's your latest on this one?
Well, given the macro, given what's going on in the world at the moment, I can't help but think that defence stocks are probably quite a nice place to be. You're right, it got a de-rating just at the tail end of last year. And there is a sort of de-rating just in terms of sector, because I think there was a general view that there was not going to be any threat of war over 2026, which I think, well, you can take your own view on that one. So there's a de-rating in terms of the sector, but also the results really pointed to a higher second half weighting. So there is a lot that needs to come through in the second half. I think at the time in December, they came off about 37%. They've rebounded a little bit since then. So they've got to hit that margin in half two. It is on a crazy discount to peers, but we don't really have visibility at the moment for a full look through on revenues. I think one of the other frustrating things is that the UK Defence Review, Strategic Defence Review, was supposed to come out in December, and that was really outlining where or how we were as a country going to get that capital that was going into higher defence spending and where it was going to go as well. And would have definitely been a beneficiary of the back of that, and that would have certainly helped the pipeline. So it's been very quiet, unfortunately. Mm-hmm. We've not heard anything on the detail on that strategic defence review. And until that comes through, I think the shares might be a little bit volatile. But again, this is not all about the UK. You know, they are selling their EM solutions into Italian Navy. It's not just the UK. This is an international solution that they've got for naval sonars and counter defence orders. So I'm happier longer term, But I do think there's got to be a focus on that second half to ensure that they meet this year's numbers. But it's on a crazy discount to peers, so you're not having to pay up too much to hold it. And you can prudently look through this year and see it at 12.50. And Divi is giving you, alongside the Divi, if you take into account that 12.50 kind of share price modestly over the next shorter term, then that's a 20% IRR. So that's okay. I can still see the longer term benefit of holding this business, but you might get shorter term volatility.
Is there a margin opportunity? Because I was looking at the two divisions. You've got communications and intelligence, which delivers EBIT margins of nearly 17%, okay? And they generate, obviously, most of the actual profits. And then you've got another equally large business, but in terms of sales, but sensors and effectors, and it only does 5%. So you've got the divisions are just totally different. It just as like in terms of profitability, is there an opportunity to improve the margins in the sensors and effectors to more along the lines of the communications intelligence?
Not to that extent, I don't think. It's quite Nick was out on site, and it's difficult to get synergies there really just on with the site that they have, I don't think you're going to get sensors up to 15%, but you can certainly probably get them more towards 10%, and that helps move the dial. So, there's work being done there.
Good. Okay, brilliant. Let's move to life sciences. We've got Colin. He's asking about hVIVO, which was a bit of a darling about, two or three years ago when we had the COVID, and these guys do human challenge trials in their new facility down in London. I think it's in the Docklands or something like that. And they've been hit not only by a funding problem for biotechs out in the US, but also by the head of the US Health Service, a guy called Kennedy, who doesn't like vaccines. Which, given that the hVIVO has services all the big sort of like vaccine developers and antiviral developers on a project basis, it means they've had a bit of a sort of like a soft patch in terms of order flow. The shares have been brutally sold off. I know the CEO has been buying. What's your sort of your latest on this one?
Oh, it just feels a bit binary, this one, at the moment, doesn't it? I like the business. We actually went out to see CRS, which is a business that we bought in Germany, a clinical unit there with 120 beds. And that's got a really good sales pipeline. But I think what we realised when we were out there is really, well, as we know already, it's very lumpy. You know, you get one of these trials in and you get occupancy that is effectively 100% for a number of weeks, and it's highly profitable. You get some nice upfront payments, but you get any cancellations or postponements that you obviously can do in the healthcare sector and the drug development sector, then you know you're sitting with the cost of it. So I think the CRS business is nice, and it's going to help complement the lumpiness of the UK business. But you know, you've highlighted hit the nail right in the head when it comes to the delays that they've had that are not really self-inflicted at all. You had a trial, a potential trial that was announced about a year ago, and you could maybe say they were a bit premature in announcing it. It was a letter of intent, so no contract, but a letter of intent with Iliad, a very large US business that was a potential phase 3 HCT human trial, and that was going to be quite a significant land of contract when it happened. But the issue was that I'm very clear in the statement, but the issue was that Iliad had to get this phase 3 HCT funded, or the development funded. So they were out doing a private FP fundraise. And guess what? With all the chaos in the States, that's not happened. So you've got that sitting there. And I think that really overshadowed the share price, because it was almost... people were betting on it happening. And then it hasn't happened. The funding hasn't come through. And you really need one of these large contracts a year to get earnings progression and just get the operational gearing that the business should have. So it means that I find it almost impossible to value at the moment. I do feel, though, because you just don't really know where the numbers are going to end up, they need one of those larger contracts to land. And they have, you know, got some new contract wins in CRS, but you really need to see that happening in the UK. It looks cheap if you take the view that vaccines are not going to disappear. I mean, that Iliad contract, for instance, that was for whooping cough. And if you don't have that coming through, that vaccine coming through, then you're already seeing that in the US, the instance of whooping cough in the US has just gone crazy because the existing vaccine doesn't work. So there is a need, an unmet need for the work that hVIVO is at the end of, but the delays have just been horrendous. So quite frustrating.
Yeah, I mean, I think we could wake up one morning and unfortunately find a contract research organisation, one of the really big boys, Charles River or somebody like that, LabCorp, put a number on these and just pick it up because it's something that would be brilliant for those and they could use it as their diversified service base across whole different types of research activities because they are a bit of a unique jewel in the crown because there aren't many companies have got actual licensed ability to do human travel trials because governments don't allow this to happen very often. So they've got they've definitely got a sort of like a last man standing. But anyway, we'll wait. At least the CEO and the CFO have put a lot of bread into it and they've been buying shares, haven't they?
Yeah, they have. And, you know, I've got a lot of time for more. It's very, very sensible. Yeah.
Yeah. Good. Okay, one share that has done really well for you, Tina. She's asking about Impario, which is basically a manufacturer of sustainable animal feed additives to improve sort of animals' health and nutrition and biosecurity. I mean, it's just been an absolute race. It's a thoroughbred, I imagine. What's the sort of latest on this one?
Well, latest is that they had a nice upgrade this morning. Very happy with this one. Yeah. So you go back about 15 months ago, maybe longer actually, but they had some supply chain issues, a lot of inflation in the supply chain, and they had to do a bit of a reset. But this is, and I've always said this, this business is highly operationally geared, and you start to get to the kind of revenue numbers that you're at the moment, right about sort of 45, 47 million, then you really get it chucking out cash. So I think revenue this morning was ahead by 3%, but EBITDA is coming through about 9.4 million versus the 8.1 that was expected. So that's our operational gearing just kicking through beautifully. And net cash, again, showing that earnings do just go straight through to cash. I think expectations were for about 11.9 million, and that's come through at 12.4 or 12.5. So very, very happy with it. But one of the great things that's happened over the last 12 months or so is that they'd acquired a US business called BioVet, and that's given them some fantastic integration benefits. So you didn't really have a market for their core product, Regostim, in the US, but what you're only beginning to see the benefit coming through now is that they're able to sell some of their UK and European products into the US, and they're really, again, as an unmet need, as an open market for them. But that BioVet acquisition was an absolute blinder. Very, very pleased with the way that's gone. And I think there's more to come here. And sometimes you, because they operate worldwide, and sometimes you get a surprise from, or negative surprise from some geographies, and you can have quite a bit of volatility. In Brazil a few years ago, for instance, was quite a difficult market. And of course, tariffs at different parts of the world have threatened them a little bit. But actually what you're seeing at the moment, they've now got the critical mass scale. They've got their regional hubs and sales side working pretty well. So you're in these numbers, you're seeing actually pretty much all the geographies working well. India, emerging markets, Central America. But again, that's the benefit of BioVet coming through. UK and Europe less so. But I think there's a lot more to come with this business the next 12 months. And
yeah, that
valuation-wise.
Yeah, go on. No, you're right. 14 half times PE, but that BioVet acquisition was the deal of the century because it was that capsule with inside a capsule, isn't it? So it allows farmers to basically give sort of like, you know, additives to more than one additive at one particular time. So it's easier for the animal to actually digest it and it doesn't stress the animal out. And yeah, no, it's absolutely perfect.
Yeah, it's on a 40% discount to its kind of worldwide international peers. Yeah. this is one that we don't want to get taken out, because I can see the earnings progression coming through here with much lower risk. Much lower risk than I think it's had from a geopolitical point of view of the last 12 months, and much better kind of just integration pretty much on farm. They used to sell through quite a lot of distributors, but now they've actually gone on farm with their sales team in certain areas, and that just means it's really sticky. If you've got somebody in your own company that's pitching up to a farmer and has got that relationship, you don't tend to get substituted out quite as much as you might do if it's doing OEM. So yeah, happy with this one.
Brilliant. Okay, let's move to sectors. We're going to go to advertising and media. In fact, I think you've selected the only company that's actually doing well. But Colin's asking about Brave Bison, because we've had profit warnings from people like WPP, for M&C Saatchi, from all the big guys, because they've been absolutely annihilated or hit by AI and stuff. But Brave Bison shares have been roaring on. So how do you see this one going forward?
Yeah, they actually announced their earnings last week, or the week before, I can't remember, on the same day as Mission Marketing that I had a profits warning. So it shows you that, you know, if you can stop picking this market, then you can, even from a sector point of view, hopefully dodge some bullets. On this one, I think there's a couple of things going on here. We look at things in three different buckets, and this one falls into the kind of a bit of self-help. So although you've got some industry kind of headwinds, you've got some real benefit coming through from the acquisitions that they made. So you've had integration benefits coming through, which has helped. And they've been pretty active on the M&A side. They bought Mini MBA. So we've not even seen the benefit of that coming through this year. So we used to own Centre or Media. That owned the Mini MBA, and that is what it says. It's a Mini MBA, so it's a short course for MBA within marketing, and it's basically the go-to for training in the marketing space. Exceptionally well-regarded and nicely profitable. So when we saw that Brave Bison was buying Mini MBA, we were very happy to support that fundraise, given the knowledge that we had when it was within Centre Media. And I think actually Brave Bison is going to be a better home for Mini MBA than it was within Centre. So I think that's going to come through this year. But also one of the dynamics that they've got is they're very strong in sport and entertainment, and that really helped their Q4 earnings this year. And I don't think, you know, you're not having to overpay for this business. I think the analysts might have it on a kind of mid-20 times PE, which I think going in terms of a price target. But actually, you even just put it on 12 times, you can see it in the mid-80s. And this is going to be a 10 million plus EBITDA business. So I think more than justifies holding it where it is at the moment. And through the course of this year, you'll see Mini MBA coming through as well. Of course, you're going to get some headwinds through marketing spend cyclicality, but you know, here it's all about execution.
They've got a couple of guys there, is it the Green Brothers or something? And another guy on a mission to conquer the world. Great.
Yeah. I was a bit cynical about they're two brothers, and I never necessarily like investing in two brothers at the top of a farm. But we spent quite a bit of time with them both, and they're focused. They're really focused.
Oh, that's good. Hungra, that's what I like to see. Okay, another one you've done a lot of very good stock pickings in the asset management sector. We've got Tatton Asset Manager. We've got Tony asking about it. I think it basically is a sort of like a platform that allows IFAs to manage their clients through, and they've been actually seeing inflows of funds under management as more of the sort of the FCA requirements have been going to these model portfolios. How do you see this one? It's trading at about 20 times PE. I mean, the shares have done brilliantly for long-term shareholders.
Yeah, it's probably the more expensive position in our portfolio. Recent results came out, and again, that momentum has continued. And I quite like this one. But it's nice to have financial services and asset management exposure. You're not getting that kind of asset management volatility with fund flows that we've known have been a bit volatile for people like Lion Trust and others. And also, I think it's got a better quality of earnings than, say, a Rathbones or a Brooks Macdonald that have got some IT platform issues to kind of overcome. This has just been a business that has grown over the years from the right technology base, focusing on customer service and not trying to shoot the lights out in terms of performance. So they don't chase markets. So therefore, the performance over the longer term for IFAs and investors has been just really steady and not overgeared to US markets, and just quite sort of middle in the road of the road in their investment approach. But they, as you say, they're benefiting strategically because IFAs, because of regulation, are moving more and more towards MPS, those model portfolio services. And it's such a capital-light model for Tatton. They only spend $500,000 a year on CapEx. You've got the likes of Brooks Macdonald and whatever who are really having to throw money at platform spend. So, yeah, they've got their platform right. They're great at customer service. And it's really all about the investor. And that's reaping the benefits for them. So I think they've now got over 1,000 IFAs on platform, or IFA firms. And if those IFA firms are growing themselves, that feeds the AUM. So it was record net inflows this year. AUM was up 24%. And again, because of the operational gearing here, because it's a CapEx-light model, then I'm actually okay paying 20 times for it. So we're still buying that one today. And I think, you know, they're in a good place. There are very few MPS businesses out there that have got the performance and got the quality of service and just the steady platform that they can integrate with IFAs that are driving earnings. So quite happy with it. Although it is, as I say, it gives me a bit of a nosebleed when I look at the valuation sometimes.
Yeah, just how is that sort of competitive moat for model portfolios? I know you said there's very few quality businesses which offer it, but you could, I mean, I know, you know, the big guys, Hargreaves Lansdown and AJ Bell, they do a DIY type services for individual investors, but there's no, you know, other people presumably could offer model portfolios because you just need a good design and you just put people into tracker funds and the asset base and the risk that that particular person wants.
Yeah, no, you're right. No, there are other competitors out there that we monitor quite closely, like Square Mile. But actually, what you find is that, again, it's just so simple. It goes back to that customer service. You know, an IFA wants to effectively just sit and manage their clients, and they don't want too many surprises on the performance side. But they want a system that works. They want something that's platform-based, that they can roll out across every single client, that they can do portfolio reviews on quickly. And when I speak to we have investors that are IFAs as well. When I speak to IFAs that are using MPSs, and you know they get frustrated with the likes of a Square Mile because it's a bit of a, it's not the best platform. It's not well integrated with IFAs systems, and it's quite bitty. So they end up moving from the likes of Square Mile and some other competitors purely because of customer service. I think, by the sounds of it, Tatton are really easy to deal with. And that actually, for an IFA that's running their own business, is quite important. So yeah, there are quite a multitude of competitive offerings. And some people only compete on price. But Tatton are certainly at the lower end when it comes to the EMCs that they charge. But they're not the cheapest, not absolute cheapest. But yeah. It's all about that service. You just have to keep an eye on that, make sure that's still
good.
That IFAs continue to be happy.
Okay, well, let's move to industrials. These one company that you've been talking a lot about for a long time, Avingtrans, and the shares have just now hit an all-time high. Actually, these guys do sort of like niche products and services for the nuclear sector, defense, energy, all kinds of sort of like regulated industries. I think last week they also one of their companies, Hayward Tyler, is well, basically had Meta and TerraPower announcing a big deal to do huge, great, big small form nuclear reactors, and I know Hayward Tyler supplying to TerraPower, so that may help. What's your sort of your latest on this one? It just keeps seem to be going from strength to strength.
Yeah, we've talked about this one in the past, haven't we? And we've talked about it in a kind of some of the parts basis. But actually, I'm steering away from that now because I don't really want them to sell any of the businesses because they're all kind of absolutely roaring ahead, aren't they? That TerraPower, it was a $10 million nuclear pump contract. And yeah, they've got another $16 million of orders as well. So the Hayward Tyler is doing well. Booth's is doing well because that's in the nuclear space. And they've invested quite a bit in the medical imaging side of the business. That's Magnetica and Adaptix. So that medical imaging side of the business is still loss-making. So that's a bit of a drag on earnings. But, you know, you can still see double-digit earnings growth coming through here from the existing businesses. And, yeah, you can fall back on some of the parts if you like. But, you know, I think 20 times PE is okay. I can't believe I'm saying that. Normally we're looking at 10 times PE for the companies that we're investing in. But given the dynamics of and the tailwinds behind the sectors that that we've got here, I'm more than happy to be paying that. And so that gets you to, you know, in the shorter term, just over 600p, I think, versus what, 550 now. And you've got to remember that medical at the moment is a drag on earnings of about two and a bit, nearly £3 million. And I think medical over the next couple of years can easily get to an EBIT of 1 to 2 million. So you're getting the EES growth at 10%, and then you start modelling that out on an earnings basis, you can see it at, you know, close to £10, but certainly at £9 quite easily.
Yeah, I mean, that industrial business has just been, so the engineering business has just been going fabulously. And now, as I say, Adaptix also, I think they got their FDA approval, didn't they, for their new third floor? So, yeah. Oh, I can understand why shareholders are getting excited. Okay, another one which has done very well for you is Volex, headed up by Nath Rothschild. These guys do sort of like, they do high-value sort of cabling electronics for data centers, for EVs, for healthcare, and they do more commodities. They've got a sort of global footprint. They've been buying and building, and I must admit they've proved me wrong because I thought they might get hit by the tariffs, and actually they seem to be doing pretty damn well. What's your sort of latest view on them?
Good, strong business. And I think you've got sector growth here across a couple of the divisions. You've got EV that's been doing not too badly, and also, you know, the consumer side was a little bit weaker. But actually, you know, you look at the results, very strong half-year results, 13% revenue growth, 20% operating profit growth, 30% earnings growth, EPS growth. And actually, you know, you go back about 5 years ago, and this was a 5% type margin business. It's now 9-10% margins. And I think you can see that being sustained through the course of this year. So we think it's in a really strong position for these global structural growth markets that they're in. And valuation-wise, it's on about 16 times and 30p of earnings for March 27. So, you know, shorter term, you could happily see it at over £5 and versus what, 4.20, where we are at the moment. So one is a core holding for us. We've held it for about 8 years, and yeah, we want to ride this out. You know, I think there's more to come. We don't want it to get taken out. And the good thing is that Nat Rothschild himself has got a decent shareholding, and he's in the driving seat.
Yeah, I think one of their competitors for these sort of like high margin data center cabling businesses, Amphenol, out in the States.
Yeah.
And I think last time I looked at it, which it wasn't recent, but it was about 6 months ago, they had a PE of about 35 to 40.
I know. Just, give us some of that, please. Yeah, it's frustrating that some of our companies, we know, you've got, I just talked about the earnings growth here, 30% EPS growth. And you know the other companies that we've talked about, you know, the earnings, these earnings are not going backwards despite macro, and you're being able to buy these companies at such a significant discount to their international peers. It goes back to the point that you were making at the start. That we're getting M&A activity in the UK market because our companies are good and they're too cheap. But these are businesses that we do want to be holding on to for the longer term. Because yeah. They're value compounders. That's the other bucket that we look at as well. And Rolex is definitely in that value compounding box with some great tailwinds from the sectors that we've just talked about.
Yeah. I mean, if Amphenol ever decided to put a number on them, I mean, they could easily pay 30%, even 50% more, 22, 25 times multiple, and then they'd get an uplift because their own shares at 35 or 40, whatever it is. So it's an easy arbitrage one, if nothing else. Yeah. Okay, let's go to the last one in the engineering. We've got Flowtech Fluid Power. It's been in sort of turnaround mode probably for about 5 years. These guys do distribution of fluid power hydraulic parts around the around the UK, but have actually interestingly moved into services. And I know the CEO is well thought of, Mike England, seems to be doing a good job, but everywhere they've turned, they've seemed to be getting hit a bit, but the margins are improving. How do you see this one anyway?
I mean, after my enthusiasm there for Rolex, I take a bit of a deep breath on this one. I kind of want to have exposure to these markets, but every market that they've got really at the moment seems to have a pretty strong headwind. You've got a little bit of gross margin improvement, and they talked about, I think in their more recent results, they talked about June being a really strong month, but you know, that's one month out of 12. And I don't think, you know, that's enough to extrapolate out for the full year. So, you know, have to a little bit stronger at the tail end of 2024. Profits in line this year. Gross margin improved a little bit, but, you know, like for likes, just a bit challenging. So I wonder whether, you know, this maybe should be part of something bigger. Maybe they should be out having a look at something themselves just to get a little bit more critical mass. They have managed to get some synergies from recent acquisitions. It's one that I do find quite difficult to value at the moment as well, just because the forecastability isn't that easy. But I quite like the end markets that you should get some tailwind at some point, I think.
Yeah, eventually it should hopefully come through. Let's go to building materials, building products. And we all know that this sector has really struggled. In fact, you had Marshalls, the sort of paving stones boys, coming out with a sort of like an uncertain outlook. Let's go to, Keith is asking about James Latham, the UK's number one sort of timber merchant. Trades about 10.5 times PE, got a bunch of net cash, 5 times EBITDA. But I think one of its big competitors, interestingly, went bust about 6 months ago. So how did you see this one sort of progressing?
We've owned James Latham for, I think, as long as I've been around, it feels like. It's a quality operator. You're not having to pay up too much for it. I think what I like about them is that they're quite prudent. They've got net cash in the balance sheet. So their competitor, whose name I can't remember, they went bust because they had too much debt. So, they're really disciplined on capital returns. And I think, you know, the valuation is undemanding for a cyclically improving story as well. You know, we're pretty careful about where we're placed when it comes to house building and exposures, where, you know, you don't really want to be purely riding on the sector, because I think, you know, we've clearly had a bit of a tough time, and it's quite difficult to time the market when it comes to this sector, the house building sector. But it's a solid operator, and the full year prelims flagged okay volumes, but probably most important, margins held around about 16.8-17%. Amid a mixed kind of shift to lower price products. So good operators, I think, is the badge that I put on them.
Yeah. So, I think the one which went bust was National Timber Group.
Should remember that one.
No, I've forgotten it as well. And they've got over 50 million of cash, but a big chunk of that has been earmarked for this new, they're building a new distribution centre out in... I'm not sure where it is. Why are they doing that? Why are they just basically hiring a big distribution centre from somebody?
Margin.
You know?
Margin. They're good at investing for the long term. And I think, you know, they've been battered about a little bit over the years just by having too much variability in the distribution costs. So this just helps them lock in that margin for the longer term. It's as simple as that. But yeah, they're spending their cash.
Right. Okay. Yeah. I mean, I would have thought they're in the timber merchant type business. They're not in the distribution logistics type business, but maybe they think they are. I don't know. I'd use somebody else's facility to save the cash and go and load lock stock barrel from day one. But I'm an accountant.
Yeah. You know, there were quite a lot of questions at the time when they announced that. I think these are another operator that prides themselves on service, customer service, and delivery. You know, that's how they actually manage to keep clients and get a little bit of growth in a difficult market. So really it is all about shipping and getting it out there to the customer very timely. So we'll see how that pays off. They've always been quite fixated in return on invested capital. So let's see how that plays through in the next couple of years, or at least 5 years out to it.
Okay, good. Well, I've got last one coming up. We've got Damien. I don't know whether you still own this. I know you've talked about it before. We've got Ashtead Technology came out with some results today. They do marine rental equipment and stuff. Shares are 12%. I don't know whether you can talk about it because I don't know whether you own it, but have you got any sort of thoughts on Ashtead at all?
No real insight, to be honest. We sold it fortunately ahead of them going or making the announcement that they were going from AIM to full list. And we sold it on the back of on valuation grounds and visibility, pipeline visibility at that point. And I suppose there was a little bit of luck there on the timing of it. We kind of got in out before the kind of rush of any of the AIM IHT folk disappeared. So we've not really been following it since then. So yeah. No great insight there, I'm afraid. But you know, it was a good business, well run, and we were happy to own it when it wasn't really the darling that it started to become.
Yeah. Okay, good. Let's do the final one then. In that case, we've got Brian. He's asking about the Property Franchise Group, which I think is basically sort of like a franchise company for estate agents. It bought Belvoir, merged with them, uh-huh. and then it's got its own ones. And I think 50% of its income comes from lettings and 50% comes from transactions. Obviously, it's been a bit tough the last 6 months heading into the budgets. We've had profit warnings from Winkworth and just recently, and also from Foxtons. How do you see this one?
Yeah, another capital light business. Attractive cash conversion, good dividends as well. So, you know, the risks are obviously prolonged housing market sluggishness, franchisee model as well, and just making sure that recruitment does fall through. But, you know, that Belvoir acquisition, which I think completed nearly a year ago, has really enlarged the recurring lettings base and FS capability as well. So, very, very happy with the overall dynamic here. I think there's a bit of self-help because there's synergy captures, hopefully, and cross-sell into the combined networks. And that really will sort of begin to filter through this year. And, you know, mortgage market normalisation. Oh, I don't know. I'm going to get that this year. Interest rates, who knows? This is a bit of a play on housing transaction recovery. You know, the other business that we've got in this space is Springfield Properties, which is highly unique because of its exposure to the north of Scotland and the energy network rollout. So, you know, two very, very different businesses here, quite like TPFG, just for that more kind of mainstream housing transaction exposure. But Springfield, we're still getting that, but highly specialist in the north of Scotland.
Yeah. Is there any risk from the new renters' rights bill, which I think starts in April, doesn't it? Because you could argue that more and more buy-to-let landlords are going to be moving out of the market, which is going to leave it to the big boys like, you know, the private equity guys, Brookfield and Grainger and people like that.
Yeah, I mean, this is a sector that's had headwinds against the private landlord for the last 2 years, really, isn't it? And it's despite that, TPFG has managed to still, you know, churn out some low digit growth. So, you know, they're the number one in the space now. So I'm happy enough to hold it. And it won't all go to the large players. There's always going to be some of the smaller private individuals about the place. There's so much demand for rental property.
Yeah, no, you're right. There definitely is. Okay, brilliant. Well, we've just come to the end of it, end of the interview. Just in terms of your favourite stock or stock idea for the next sort of like year or 2 years, anything we've talked about or anything else you'd like just to highlight to investors?
You know, this is like choosing your favorite child, isn't it?
It's brilliant. I love it.
I'm going to go for Impario.
Okay.
Because I think we've got that operational growth coming through now. And, you know, as I say, once they hit that kind of 45, which they now have, 45 of revenues, the business, I think, 3 or 4 years ago was too dependent on too many SKUs. But the OrigoStim product is, you know, it's a great product. And they've only just started selling that into the US. So there we go. That's fine. That's my one for the year.
Yeah, I thought you were going to say, before you actually mentioned Impario, I would have bet some money on it was Eagle Eye, actually, because you did say that.
You know, it's 50-50. It's 50-50. Yeah. We're very happy to have both in the portfolio. I think Eagle Eye is, you know, it's going to, the first kind of sniff of those SAP numbers coming through, then there's going to be an upgrade. There'll definitely be an upgrade coming through on the back of the SAP. Now I'm changing my mind. Can I have two? Can I have Eagle Eye and...
You can, we'll let you. But you can't have 15.
Okay, fair enough. I'll take those two.
All right, brilliant. Well, thanks everyone for your questions. Massive thanks again, Judith, for those brilliant insights, and really hoping, like you, that we start seeing some tailwinds in the small and mid-cap sector, because there's significant undervaluation, and it should eventually, that valuation should come through. So thanks again, and look forward in chatting about 6 months' time.
Great. See you soon.
The Vox Markets Podcast. Nothing in this podcast is intended as investment advice, and the people in this podcast may hold positions in the stocks they talk about. Do not buy anything based solely on a tip or recommendation. Please do your own research.